This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Have a listen to this. Have a listen to this.
Now, that kind of talk this week dragged Australia's share market to
this
a two-year low.
There are, of course, complex Stephen reasons for that.
He was the big spender. Right. The big spender.
Doing the grocery shopping could take a huge chunk out of the family budget.
And that's finance.
Hello and welcome to Comedian versus Economist. We demystify the world of money and help you get a handle on the bigger picture. My name's Adam, and we're joined as always by my little older brother and real life economist, Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, good, Adam. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right, it's fair to say. I was sampling some of the produce and delights of the Clare Valley wine region yesterday for a friend of mine's 50th birthday. So a little shady today, but we'll power on. We'll power on because we have got a big show coming up. ScoMo's on tour. Scotty from marketing, he's at COP26 talking climate action. COP, of course, being the conference of the parties, which explains why it's still going. It's just one party after another. Elon Musk, entrepreneur and richest man in the world, can do a lot of things, Thomas, but can he end world hunger? We're going to find out. And apparently 3% of people in the finance sector are psychopaths. Meanwhile, amazingly, a whopping 83% of psychopaths are actually office workers named Karen. But first, CommBank has taken the plunge into the murky waters of crypto. Thomas, does this mean mum and dad can finally buy some Doge?
No. CBA is offering crypto on their banking app now, so you can buy 10 cryptocurrencies. Right. Including Bitcoin, Ethereum, Bitcoin Cash, and Litecoin. But it's a closed-loop system, so you can't buy on other exchanges and then bring it into your app. So you've got to buy through the app itself.
Right.
And then store it there. So it's a closed-loop system. But they're offering it to their customers, saying that their customers are increasingly asking for it. There's strong demand that they've seen. Mm. And so they're going to do it. They've teamed up with Gemini, which is a New York-based firm run by the Winklevoss twins. Crypto celebrities.
They invented Facebook, didn't they? That was their claim to fame initially. Mm. And then Zuckerberg stole it and turned it into billions of dollars. That's then the renamed legend. It. He's called it Meta now.
Mm,
yeah. But they went off and just made billions anyway.
Yeah, they did.
Crypto.
They turned out all right. Mm. Yeah, so they're paired up with them. They run an exchange and custodian service. They've teamed up with blockchain analysis firm Chainalysis, which sort of provides a lot of the regulatory stuff that they need to do to be able to make this offering. Yeah, so they've paired up with those guys, offering it to their customers. So, yeah, strong play from CBA, I reckon. It's a bit of a flex. Like, they're the first big bank to offer it. And I think one of the things I've seen in the reporting of it is saying it's a good, strong play for them because crypto is just cool, right? Like, it's cool right now. Mm. It's something young people are into. And so there's big branding power in this by just going like, yeah, we're down with crypto. You can get crypto through the app.
Doesn't that come with risk, though? Because the crypto space is famous for being so volatile. Like, if it all goes pear-shaped, if CommBank start offering crypto and going, yeah, we're cool, we're hip with the kids, and all the kids lose like 80% of their house deposit, then that's not going to reflect too well on CBA, is it?
Yeah, it's not really CBA's problem, I don't think.
Well, that's a bit rich.
Well, no, I mean, apparently when you go to purchase crypto, there is a little notification that comes up that reminds you that crypto is a risky asset to be investing in.
Right.
Apparently. So that's how CBA is covering themselves there.
Next finish. Skip, whatever. trying to buy crypto.
Mute notifications.
We all read those notifications, don't we? You know, when like the end user license agreement. Just study it in depth.
Yeah, but I think it's not CBA's problem, and I think CBA know that if they don't offer it to their clients will just go and do it somewhere else because it's not that hard. Like, I'm kind of surprised, as you know, you and I both seasoned crypto investors. Like, yes. It's a bit lame in the sense of you just have access to 10 coins and that's it. Doesn't go very far. And given how hard it is to go and register with an exchange, let alone set up your own wallet or anything, it's not particularly hard. So it's a pretty, you know, entry level offering. But I think they needed to do it because they would know that, you know, the demand's there and people would leave them to set up somewhere else. So this allows them to hold onto their customer base a little longer.
But no, they wouldn't. I wouldn't leave my bank where my home loan is because they didn't offer me crypto. Like, I look at it like a sports betting account. I don't want CommBank offering me odds on the fifth race at Dapto. Like, that's where I place crypto, and maybe that's changing, and maybe this is a recognition of it changing. But to me, crypto to now, and maybe it's also my investment philosophy around crypto, is I'm not even like in on Bitcoin. I'm looking more down your shitcoin end of the spectrum for those big gains. So maybe it is that by limiting it to the top 10 or whatever it is, and saying, you know what, these are in the Wild West, these are the safest ones, you know, relatively speaking. But I don't know. I don't really buy that anyone's leaving CommBank because they can't buy their crypto there.
Not leaving CommBank, but like leaving the CommBank ecosystem. Like, they want to be the home of people's finance. Like, they want to offer full solution. It's like, it's retail, it's everyday banking, it's insurance, it's wealth management, all of that sort of thing. And so crypto is part of that ecosystem. And so as much as possible, CBA wants to own the entire ecosystem for each of their customers, as much as possible. And I think that's the idea, and that's the motivation driving it. Okay. I think the interesting thing for me is, like, a lot of people, particularly in the crypto community that I'm reading, talk about how this legitimizes crypto, and I don't think that's the case, because CBA has no skin in the game here. You know, like, they're not up for losing any money. They're not investing their own assets in crypto. They're just making it available to their customers. I feel like the analogy here is like if you bought a plane ticket to Afghanistan and you bought it, and then you go, well, Qantas is willing to fly me to Afghanistan, therefore Qantas thinks Afghanistan is safe and a good place to live in. But that's not what Qantas thinks. Qantas thinks that they can take your money and fly you to Afghanistan and not get shot down. Like, and that's all that implies, that they can drop you off and get out of there before they get burnt. And so that's what I think it is. I think it is true that it is pointing to a growing demand base at the retail level for crypto investments, but I don't think it's the big institutional tick of approval that a lot of people are hyping it up as.
We actually had an email this week from, and apologies if I get the pronunciation wrong, it's Tom, but it's spelled T-O-M-E. So before you hang me out there. But he was sort of asking the same thing. He's saying, like, is this, you know, CBA getting into it, they're kind of going into it without carrying any of the risk. So they're able to offer these products without carrying any of the risk. And I think a lot of the trading platforms really do that, don't they? They're essentially offering you a way into the market, but without carrying the risk. Like, they're not holding anything, are they?
No.
I mean, CBA is not holding anything in this instance. No. They're just the vehicle through which you can buy some crypto. But then I also read a quote the other day that said, if it's not your wallet, it's not your crypto. So where does it sit?
With Gemini, I think. So they just give you, so it's on. The thing is, there's know your customer regulations on the banks. So the banks, to prevent money laundering, they have to know where the money is and who owns it. And so there's zero privacy around your ownership of crypto through CBA's banking app, which is kind of interesting because that's often touted as the big selling point of Bitcoin, is that it's completely anonymous and no one has any idea who owns what. But CBA has a ledger of what you own in terms of your crypto holdings.
So you can't transfer it out to your own, to like a cold storage wallet?
No.
Something like that?
No.
That's part of the deal, part of what you sign up for.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I don't imagine, you know, I don't imagine there's too many boomers banking through CBA, dipping their toe in the crypto sphere and immediately going, well, this is all well and good, but I'd really like to offload this into my cold storage wallet.
In the refrigerator down in the shed.
Do you reckon this is the start? Will we be able to buy things at, like, can you shop at Woolies with crypto soon? Like, is this, once it becomes mainstream, will they link it to your debit cards and start using it in that way?
I still think that's a fair way off. Like, you can't purchase anything with this. This is purely an investment. And they asked Matt Common whether he thought Bitcoin was an investment, a speculative investment. Like, is it an asset class or is it a currency? And he danced around.
Or is it a lotto ticket?
And he didn't really want to be drawn on that question. But yeah, you can't purchase anything with this. It sits in the app, and you can't use it to, you know, go buy anything.
All investment's speculative to a degree, though, isn't it? Like, we're just talking degrees of speculation. You're speculating on the fact that it's going to go up. That's
yeah, to an extent. I mean, yeah, traditionally, like, you might draw a distinction between investing is something that pays a return, that has some sort of yield. So, like, you invest in a company, you get a share of the profits, and that's what you're investing in, theoretically. Like, you know, mostly you're buying because you want the value of your companies to go up, but you're investing, in theory, you're investing because you want a share of that company's profits.
Mm.
When it comes to currencies, and not just blockchain, but like Bitcoin, but all currencies, there's no yield, there's no return from owning Aussie dollars, US dollars, Bitcoin, whatever. And so as an investment vehicle, it's purely speculative. It's in the sense I'm just buying because I think it's going to be worth more when I want to sell it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I get it. If that's the definition of speculative, you're buying hoping that it goes up rather than buying to own.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not to say all share investing is not speculative, but
yeah, no, all of mine is, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right, Thomas, it's all over the news at the moment. The Conference of the Parties, COP26, happening in Glasgow. Everyone's talking climate change, climate action. ScoMo's over there. What's he brought to the table?
Big win for Australia, big win. Mm. We're committed to do net zero, really. You're going to do very little. That's a big win. He really brought that home. Yeah, a little Aussie battlers punching above its weight in terms of the war on the environment. So, yeah, big win. We did have the Australian stall apparently was splashed with the branding of Santos, big gas producer.
Climate action brought to you by Santos.
Yeah.
Is that what it was?
Yes. No, and they were touting the carbon capture technology as saying this is Australia's contribution to...
It's cutting edge. It's cutting edge technology, isn't it?
Yeah, well,
it's so cutting edge, it hasn't been invented yet.
Yeah, it hasn't. No, yeah, it's a distant future. Like, he's a visionary, Scott Morrison. He's looking way into the future and pinning all of our contribution to saving the planet on this fictional technology that's going to be delivered by some of the companies that just happen to be big financial backers of the coalition, just as it happens. Mm. But yeah, but carbon capture technology doesn't really work yet. We did have an announcement through the week, actually, that Gorgon has spent $3 billion is run by Chevron up in WA, I think it is. They're running a carbon capture process up there, and it has sequestered 5 million tons of carbon dioxide.
Well, that's good.
It was supposed to do 40. So it's a little bit of a miss.
It's a start.
Yeah. It's a start. Significant milestone was Chevron's words.
Yeah.
But they're now having to go back.
You can't get 40 without 5 first, can you? We're on the way. It's in the bank.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, yeah, hanging the hat on that, selling that to the world. I mean, kind of the funny thing here, as an economist looking at this, is you had the carbon tax, right? So Gillard brought in the carbon tax. And this was widely seen in economics. A carbon tax is seen as a pretty, or a carbon price, it kind of works out being the same thing, as seen as a good way to do things, because you set the price and then the market decides how it's going to meet those targets, and you create market incentives, and with that incentive process, it brings together your most efficient solutions. It brings them to the fore and promotes those.
How does it do that, though? Does it do that by, so it puts a price on carbon? Is that what it does? It puts a price on carbon, and then it gets what, more expensive the more, you know. How is the price calculated? How is it?
It's just set. So like if you're gonna emit carbon, then you have to pay a price depending on how much carbon you're emitting, and the price is set by the government. But because that creates a financial incentive. So if you're a polluter in that sense, you need to reduce. The more you reduce, the more you save. And then you're going to go to, and then that creates an incentive.
It's not the opposite where you get discounts if you buy more.
no.
Buy in bulk and save on your carbon price.
So it creates that incentives. And then the solution is just whatever's going to be most cost effective. And so you end up with more cost effective solutions because it's driven by the market. And that's what...
Right.
In economic theory, that's what the market does very well, is it allocates resources efficiently to their best use. And it does that naturally without having to get all hands on in it and kind of figure it out manually. The market just takes care of that. Like the market as a system is able to process a lot of complex information because there's a lot of people looking at it. And the price as a mechanism transmits that information through the system very quickly and very effectively.
What's a practical analogy that people would understand? Another kind of, and when I say people, me, but but I mean, like the price of petrol, the price of something, where, like, I'm struggling to relate the carbon price and how that's just magically maintained and updated by the market.
The price is set by the government,
right?
But then once that creates an incentive in the market system for people to meet that, to respond to that, like it creates a cost around, that's why they call it a carbon price. It creates a cost around carbon that now people want to avoid that cost.
Right. So So the market's not dictating the price in any way. They're not. It's not adjusting the price based on what's happening in the market. In the way that supply and demand works, when you've got, if there's a lot more demand, the price goes up, and then vice versa. Yeah, the price is just a flat price that's set, and the market then just goes, well, we've got to sort out our backyard so that we're not having to pay it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It introduces a cost into the system, and then that, because at the moment you can emit carbon and you don't have to pay for it. But now that introduces the cost into the system, and then that incentivizes firms to avoid that cost and to do that in the most cost-efficient way.
Right.
And so that's sort of how it works. And that's why, so in terms of economic theory, economists like carbon prices. Like that's, you know, seen as the most efficient way to do it. And that's pretty global sort of thing. But that became the carbon tax, and then that became Labor's tax and Labor's big tax agenda, and then Abbott got elected and he killed the carbon tax. And mostly not because he was really ideologically against it, but because Labor had come up with it and he's in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. And so they shut that down and went to direct action. So in that system, they're funding people to not pollute and paying to do it.
Well, that seems more open to... potential sort of, well, yeah. Well, if we're starting to pay people to do things, like, so we're talking about paying corporations to reduce their emissions. I feel like we're then flipping the accountability for how the money's spent over to the corporations, and they may or may not be using the money to do that. They might go, well, we'll put half of what you gave us towards carbon reduction, and we'll put the other half into this thing we want to build. This.
Economists don't like direct action. No, right. There's not much to like about it. It's seen that the government's got to be picking winners. It's a lot of administration. They've got to monitor it. They've got to have integrity to make sure that the companies are doing what they're saying. It's not really seen as a winner. Yeah, so they went. I mean, but the other thing you think about it is that a carbon price or a carbon tax puts the price on the polluters, so they've got to pay it. The tax falls on the polluters, and then we all benefit. With direct action, the government's paying for it through taxation revenue on households. So we've now reversed that flow. So households are now paying money to corporations to stop polluting, which is also a little bit like, that's not a great outcome.
No.
But it gets worse because we've now gone to direct action where we're now paying companies like Santos. So Santos just got a grant, funding on a controversial government scheme that pays companies to lower emissions for more carbon capture technology. So we're now taxing households to pay corporations for technology that at the moment doesn't actually work.
Right. Yeah, it's not good, is it?
It's a bit lame. It's a bit in the middle of a climate crisis. It's a bit lame, and it's sort of like, I don't know, the thing that I do find this personally quite frustrating is that, you know, we often talk about coalition being the political party of business, but it's not of business in general. It's not of free markets, because this is the exact opposite of what free market economists would tell you to do. It's the company of particular businesses, and businesses are that are paying their donations. So. Yeah, it's grim. Like, I'll be honest, there's not a lot of joy in this story for me.
Right, and so this is the solution that we've taken to the COP26. How was it received?
Do you know? Derision, I think.
Other countries are just like, wow, you must have some very wealthy citizens.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's a lot of respect for Australia on the world stage right now, but I don't know.
Well, you wait, though. When that technology comes in, then they'll all come begging to Australia for our patents and our...
So let me give you just to end with one more stat. So the UN reckons we need to remove 17 billion tonnes of carbon every year, 17 billion tonnes. Yep. Your average power station, like Lidl produces 6 million tonnes a year. All of the current carbon capture schemes in the world all together right now save 9,000 tonnes.
A year?
A year.
Well, that's just a is year. That to
yeah.
date.
To date. It might be to date.
Tons captured since inception. We just ticked over 9,000. It's a milestone.
So it's not even a fraction of a single power station.
Well, it's early days, Thomas. It's early days. You know, when electric cars first came out, they couldn't make it to the end of the driveway. Now you can get all the way around the block. And so, no, but you're right. It does seem a long way off. I'm sure ScoMo's got it under control. It's in safe hands. All right, let's take a quick break there. We'll grab a word from this week's sponsors and be back with more Comedian versus Economist right after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back here on Comedian versus Economist. Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Instagram at CVE Podcast. Or we'd love it if you sent us an email, cve@equitymates.com or via the website equitymates.com/CVE. And in fact, Ariel sent us a message via email, and she was asking about Elon Musk's, she wanted to get our thoughts, probably your thoughts mostly, Thomas, it's fair to say, on Elon Musk's comments about ending world hunger. So I don't know, you would have seen this during the week. The head of the World Food Program said there was a headline that read that we can end world hunger with $6 billion, which is only 2% of Elon Musk's wealth. And Elon said, I'll give you $6 billion if you can prove how it will work. And then the World Food Program guy was like, well, it won't work, but can we have $6 billion anyway, please? And then just pause. And Elon Musk has left the conversation. So what did you make of it?
That's right. I mean, to be fair to the World Food Program won the 2020 Nobel Peace Prize because it's ending world hunger. Particularly, it's been waging a campaign to stop the use of hunger as a weapon of war. So they're doing some good work. And so the head is David Beasley. He did an article. He did an interview somewhere, and basically they're saying they're $6 billion short of their fundraising target, without which 42 million people are going to die, you know, their estimates. And he's saying, look, that's only 2% of Elon Musk's wealth. He could chip in, and then they turn that into a headline, which is Musk could solve world hunger with $6 billion. Which wasn't actually the point he was making. And Musk was like, oh, well, if I can do that, you show me how and I'll give you $6 billion. And he's like, well, okay, so that's not actually what I said. Won't solve world hunger, but it will prevent geopolitical instability, mass migration, and save 42 million people on the brink of starvation.
Not enough, said Elon. Not good enough.
No.
Well, it's ending world hunger with my $6 billion or it's nothing. I don't want any of your geopolitical stabilization.
No, yeah. Well, I mean, I was following this conversation up today to see where it went. David Beasley said, let's talk. I'll fly to you if you want. It's not as complicated as Falcon Heavy, which is one of SpaceX's heavy space launch vehicles. But there's too much at stake to not have a conversation. I can be on the next flight to you. Throw me out if you don't like what I have to hear. Musk then at some point changed his Twitter handle to Lord Edge and had his account suspended.
What?
His account suspended, so we haven't heard from him since then.
That explains why there hasn't been a lot of movement in Doge recently either. Right. Is it still suspended? Is Elon Musk's account genuinely suspended?
When I was on Twitter today, that's what it was telling me.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know what for. Didn't tell me what for. But
I don't know. Did you ask? Did you let them know who you were?
Yeah. I'm recording tonight. Can you just...
Yeah. I really want to be current on this. Right.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, ending world hunger isn't as simple as just giving people lots of food, because... As the WFP notes, that it's the conflict is one of the biggest sources of famine, and so the big flashpoints for famine right now are Yemen, South Sudan, Nigeria, Afghanistan. So the conflict hot points are there. That's where you're likely to have people fall into famine, and so that's not so much a question of once you've got conflict, then getting food to people becomes a real challenge, regardless of the economics. That said, we're also in the middle of the COVID crisis, which has created a whole bunch of problems as well. I was talking to a mate of mine, actually I can't mention his name because he's an actual economist and doesn't want to be associated with hacks like us.
We'll get him on the show.
Yeah, should.
We'll blur out his face.
Put a filter on his voice. There's energy costs are up, so that feeds into food prices. But one of the weird things about it is that there's now biofuels is being seen as a sustainable energy, But biofuels are run on things like corn and things like that. And so poor people in the world are now competing with biofuel companies for basic grains and things like this.
Right.
Which is a real challenge. And the other thing is that, yeah, that not only are poor people in developing countries competing with biofuel companies, they're also competing with cows. That a lot of grain and world food goes to feeding cows in the developing world. And because the developed world loves their cows so much that, yeah, they're willing to pay a good price for it. So they're getting outbid by cattle farms. So this is sort of some of the challenges that the UN's worried about right now, and it's looking at potentially going to be quite a challenging year. China, Bloomberg was running a story saying that China is warning people to stock up on food because they're worried about what's going to happen coming into winter.
That's a desperately sad situation, that people are going hungry so that we can feed cows so that we can eat them. That's pretty horrific when you put it in those terms.
Yeah, it is. It's, yeah, that's not humanity winning.
No, it makes me feel very guilty about my lunch in the Clare Valley yesterday.
Yeah.
Delicious as it was.
That's right. I mean, inequality is pretty brutal, and I think, like, you don't often realize this living in Australia, like, how wealthy and lucky we are. Yeah, the rest of the world is nowhere near as lucky as we are.
So, yeah. I mean, the other thing it highlighted to me was just the enormous wealth that someone like Elon Musk has. Like, he's the richest man in the world now by, like, a country mile. I think he's like, richer than the next two guys put together. And those guys are pretty stinking rich. So, yeah, it's kind of the fact that he could potentially even come close to making a significant contribution with 2% of the wealth and releasing $6 billion onto the world to make even a big dent in a problem like world hunger just kind of says to me, like, so we pay $50 a month to World Vision, right? Mm. That's one of the things that we do to give. And here's Elon Musk, like, with the ability, whether he chooses to or not, but he's got the ability potentially to pay $6 billion. So it kind of makes a bit of a mockery of the rest of us who are like, well, here's $50, like a little bit here, a little bit there, when someone like that could just go, you know what? In fact, if we really sort of get behind it, then if he actually did pay, we could all get our $50 a month back.
Back, yeah.
Because then it'd be fixed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the irony is that for me, it's like, you know, it's galling to see, like, the UN trying to bail up billionaires to get them to chip in and save 42 million people from dying. Like, that's a pretty horrible outcome. But it's also the system that creates billionaires is the same system that is taking food from the developing world to feed cows in the developed world. That's sort of, that's how a capitalist system works. And, you know, the reason why there is still world hunger, you know, conflict is a story, yes, but, like, a lot of that conflict comes from the way resource-rich countries have been shafted by colonial countries. So there's a sort of systemic kind of picture here that, I don't know, maybe it's sort of coming more into the fore and kind of see, like, yeah, the world that gives us billionaires also gives us 42 million people on the brink of starvation.
Interesting. In fact, Ariel, we can just finish with this just super quick question that she had here. What would a realistic roadmap out of world hunger look like economically and logistically? Thomas, have you got a quick answer to that?
Bumpy, I think. Quick answer to that.
Yeah, it's complicated. All right, quick one to finish, Thomas. And there was a headline that caught my eye this week, one of the articles that you share with me, that said that 3% of people in the financial sector are psychopaths. What kind of detailed, in-depth research went into this statistic?
I think it was just a survey. People self-nominated.
Publicity opportunity. Oh.
Yeah, on a scale,
I don't mind being referred to as a psychopath if it gets me in the AFR.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're interviewing this guy, Manfred Ketz de Vries. He's a leading leadership expert. He's a trained economist and then got into psychotherapy and then now teaches leadership. Wrote 7 books in 2020, apparently.
In 1 year.
Mm. Yeah, he's a machine.
They're not very good.
Who knows?
I mean, I didn't write any.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't slag him off too much. But I feel like if you're pumping out that kind of quantity, there's got to be some compromise on quality.
Yeah, you find a formula. It's like Enid Blyton, who wrote Famous Five and Magic Faraway Tree. She wrote 200 books.
Whoa. You're not slagging off Enid Blyton, one of the... She was one of the greatest children's authors of all time.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what I'm saying. She found a formula, made it work.
Right.
Just churned it out. And I reckon Ketz de Vries is doing the same thing. But yeah, they're asking him about, just a general leadership question. And he's like, well, he reckons 1% of the population are psychopaths. In the financial sector, it's probably
3%. Probably 3%.
Yeah.
So. Jeez, this is falling apart pretty quickly. Yeah. Is this an excerpt from one of his books? It's probably 3%.
Probably 3%.
You know, what do you base that on, Manfred? That's just a hunch.
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who's had to work with financial sector CEOs. So I mean, it's based on you know, it's something. Basically, he's just slagging off the people he's had to work with. I don't want to work with in the finance sector. They're all psychopaths.
I mean, I imagine there's a lot of, like, I think there are a lot of traits that would serve you well in those kind of high-pressure roles. You know, like, the psychopaths are typically kind of narcissistic sort of, you know, self-promoters, aren't they? Like,
I think so. I don't know.
So I think you'd have to be a little bit of psychopath to just have a little touch.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Where does psychopath end and go-getter begin?
Yeah, you'd really love it if your boss described you as a real go-getter. But if someone asked you, is he going for your next job, and you put your old boss down as a reference, if your boss said, well, he was a bit of a psychopath, to be honest. I don't think you're getting that next job. I actually did some searching. It was part of my in-depth research. The top 10 jobs, Thomas, where you're most likely to find psychopaths. Oh, number 10 is a civil servant, so in the public service, probably no great surprise. Chefs came in at number 9.
Oh, yeah. Of course. They're under a lot of pressure.
They are. But that's a bad combination, like psychopaths with access to lots of sharp knives. A clergy person came in at number 8. Didn't strike me as someone under a lot of pressure or in need of shameless self-promotion. Police officers apparently attract those traits as well. Journalist was at number 6. Surgeons was at number 5.
Surgeons?
Yeah. Surgeons. Whoa. I don't know. Just that maybe it's like a power trip of opening someone up. I don't know. Number 4 was salespeople. Number 3 was media, so TV and radio presenters. I presume that doesn't extend to your average podcast host. Number 2 was lawyers. And then the number one profession attracting psychopaths apparently is CEOs, which to me is just really broad. Like, you just start a company and call yourself the CEO, which I guess if you do that, maybe you've got psychopathic tendencies.
Bryce and Al, CEOs of Equity Mates.
It's true. Equity Mates. I always knew it. They come across as such nice guys, but deep down. Yeah. But if you're looking at the other end of the spectrum, then the jobs with the least psychopaths, number 10 was accountants. Number 9, interestingly, was doctors. So if you go and see a doctor, then you're not likely to find a psychopath until you get referred by the doctor to the surgeon. Yeah. Number 9, creative artist. Number 7 was a teacher. 6, charity worker. Number 5, a beautician or stylist. That one surprised me a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why. I think... Yeah. Number 4, craftsperson. Number 3, therapist. 2, nurse. And number 1, a care aide. So a lot of the sort of more caring type supportive roles.
I think if you line that up against income for those professions, I think there's a pretty tight correlation. Mm. Seems like, which I think gets to the point about a go-getter, you know, like a lot of psychopathic tendencies do you very well in our economy, putting yourself above others, self-promotion, using others to your own ends. I don't know what defines a psychopath, but like they're the kind of things that get you ahead and get you into those high-paying roles. Okay, I think we got a system that funnels psychopaths to the top.
Encourages them.
Yeah. I think I know where we're going wrong. God, this has been a cheery show this week.
Hasn't it? Yeah, we've covered world hunger and why the capitalist society is no good.
Climate crisis, why that can't be fixed.
Why that can't be fixed. And it all boils down to the fact that everything's run by psychopaths. All right. Well, good to have you along again. As always, I'm Comedian versus Economist. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Don't forget lots of other great shows across Equity Mates Media, Equity Mates Investing Podcast, Get Started Investing, You're in Good Company, Talk Money to Me. By all means, send us an email, cve@equitymates.com or on the website, equitymates.com/CVE, or join us on Instagram and Facebook at CVE Podcast. Don't forget too, there's Crypto Curious, which I think is starting this week. The feed is definitely live, so go and get that if you're into crypto and maybe wanting to find out more about what CommBank's doing. I'm sure they'll be all across that. So, yeah, as I say, thank you very much for joining us. Thomas, thank you for joining me once again.
Thank you.
And we will talk to you all next week. Bye.
Comedian vs. Economist is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Comedian vs. Economist are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Comedian vs. Economist acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Liberty's leave policy was tremendous. Having the ability to take 16 weeks off, fully paid to bond with my child, was an incredible experience.
At Liberty Mutual, you can find a career that supports you at every step, even baby steps. We offer up to 16 weeks parental leave for new moms and dads. And because not everyone's pathway to parenthood looks the same, we offer robust fertility, surrogacy, and adoption benefits too. Learn more at LibertyMutualCareers.com and pursue your tomorrow today.